my attention to the journal. It was devoted to transcribing the words on the wall of the tower, was filled with so many new passages. But whether it decays under the earth or above on green fields, or out to sea, or in the very air, all shall come to revelation and to revel in the knowledge of the strangling fruit, and the hand of the sinner shall rejoice, for there is no sin in shadow or in light that the seeds of the dead cannot forgive. There were a few notes scribbled in the margins. One read, Lighthouse Keeper, which made me wonder if she'd circled the man in the photograph. Another read, North, and a third, Island. I had no clue what these notes meant, or what it said about the psychologist's state of mind that her journal was devoted to this text. I felt only a simple, uncomplicated relief that someone had completed a task for me that would have been laborious and difficult otherwise. My only question was whether she had gotten the text from the walls of the tower, from journals within the lighthouse, or from some other source entirely. I still don't know. Careful to avoid contact with her shoulder and arm, I then searched the psychologist's body. I patted down her shirt, her pants, searching for anything hidden. I found a tiny handgun strapped to her left calf and a letter in a small envelope folded up in her right boot. The psychologist had written a name on the envelope. At least, it looked like her handwriting. The name started with an S. Was it her child's name? A friend? A lover? I had not seen a name or heard a name spoken aloud for months, and seeing one now bothered me deeply. It seemed wrong, as if it did not belong in Area X. A name was a dangerous luxury here. Sacrifices didn't need names. People who served a function didn't need to be named. In all ways, the name was a further and unwanted confusion to me, a dark space that kept growing and growing in my mind. I tossed the gun far across the sand, balled up the envelope, sent it after the gun. I was thinking of having discovered my husband's journal, and how in some ways that discovery was worse than its absence, and on some level, I was still angry at the psychologist. Finally, I searched her pants pockets. I found some change, a smooth worry stone, and a slip of paper. On the paper, I found a list of hypnotic suggestions that included induce paralysis, induce acceptance, and compel obedience, each corresponding to an activation word or phrase. She must have been intensely afraid of forgetting which words gave her control over us to have written them down. Her cheat sheet included other reminders like surveyor needs reinforcement and anthropologist's mind is porous. About me, she had only this cryptic phrase, silence creates its own violence. How insightful. The word annihilation was followed by help induce immediate suicide. We had all been given self-destruct buttons, but the only one who could push them was dead. Part of my husband's life had been defined by nightmares he'd had as a child. These debilitating experiences had sent him to a psychiatrist. They involved a house and a basement and the awful crimes that had occurred there. But the psychiatrist had ruled out suppressed memory, and he was left at the end with just trying to draw the poison by keeping a diary about them. Then, as an adult at university, a few months before he joined the Navy, he had gone to a classic film festival, and there, up on the big screen, my future husband had seen his nightmares acted out. It was only then that he realized the television set must have been left on at some point when he was only a couple of years old, with that horror movie playing. The splinter in his mind, never fully dislodged, disintegrated into nothing. He said that was the moment he knew he was free, that it was from then on that he left behind the shadows of his childhood, because it had all been an illusion, a fake, a forgery, a scrawling across his mind, that it falsely made him go in one direction when he had been meant to go in another. "I've had a kind of dream for a while now," he confessed to me the night he told me he had agreed to join the 11th Expedition. "A new one, and not really a nightmare this time." In these dreams, he floated over a pristine wilderness as if from the vantage point of a marsh hawk, and the feeling of freedom is indescribable. It's as if you took everything from my nightmares and reversed it. As the dreams progressed and repeated, they varied in their intensity and their viewpoint. Some nights he swam through the marsh canals. Others, he became a tree or a drop of water. Everything he experienced refreshed him. Everything he experienced made him want to go to Area X. Although he couldn't tell me much, he confessed that he already had met several times with people who recruited for the expeditions, that he had talked to them for hours, that he knew this was the right decision. It was an honor. Not everyone was taken. Some were rejected and others lost the thread along the way. Still others, I pointed out to him, must have wondered what they had done after it was too late. All I understood of what he called Area X at the time came from the vague official story of environmental catastrophe, along with rumors and sideways whispers. Danger? I'm not sure this crossed my mind so much as the idea that my husband had just told me he wanted to leave me and had withheld the information for weeks. I was not yet privy to the idea of hypnosis and reconditioning, so it did not occur to me that he might have been made suggestible during his meetings. My response was a profound silence as he searched my face for what he thought he hoped to find there. He turned away, sat on the couch, while I poured myself a very large glass of wine and took the chair opposite him. We remained that way for a long time. A little later, he started to talk again about what he knew of Area X, about how his work right now wasn't fulfilling, how he needed more of a challenge. But I wasn't really listening. I was thinking about my mundane job. I was thinking about the wilderness. I was wondering why I hadn't done something like he was doing now, dreaming of another place and how to get there. In that moment, I couldn't blame him, not really. Didn't I sometimes go off on field trips for my job? I might not be gone for months, but in principle, it was the same thing. The arguing came later, when it became real to me. But never pleading. I never begged him to stay. I couldn't do that. Perhaps he even thought that going away would save our marriage, that somehow it would bring us closer together. I don't know. I have no clue. Some things I will never be good at. But as I stood beside the psychologist's body, looking out to sea, I knew that my husband's journal waited for me, that soon I would know what sort of nightmare he had encountered here, and I knew, too, that I still blamed him fiercely for his decision. And yet, even so, somewhere in the heart of me, I had begun to believe there was no place I would rather be than in Area X. I had lingered too long and would have to travel through the dark to make it back to base camp. If I kept up a steady pace, I might make it back by midnight. There was some advantage in arriving at an unexpected hour, given how I had left things with the surveyor. Something always warned me against staying at the lighthouse overnight. Perhaps it was just the unease of seeing the strangeness of the psychologist's wound, or perhaps I still felt as if a presence inhabited that place. But regardless, I set out soon after gathering up my knapsack full of supplies and my husband's journal. Behind me lay the increasingly solemn silhouette of what was no longer really a lighthouse, but instead a kind of reliquary. As I stared back, I saw a thin green fountain of light gushing up, framed by the curve of the dunes, and felt even more resolved to put miles between us. It was the psychologist's wound, from where she lay on the beach, glowing more brightly than before. The suggestion of some sped-up form of life burning fiercely did not bear close scrutiny. Another phrase I had seen copied in her journal came to mind. There shall be a fire that knows your name, and in the presence of the strangling fruit, its dark flame shall acquire every part of you. Within the hour, the lighthouse had disappeared into the night, and with it the beacon the psychologist had become. The wind picked up, the darkness intensified. The ever more distant sound of waves was like eavesdropping on a sinister whispering conversation. I walked as quietly as possible through the ruined village, under just a sliver of moon, unwilling to risk my flashlight. The shapes in the exposed remains of rooms had gathered a darkness about them that stood out against the night, and in their utter stillness I sensed an unnerving suggestion of movement. I was glad to soon be past them and onto the part of the trail where the reeds choked both the canal on the seaward side and the little lakes to the left. In a while I would encounter the black water and cypress trees, vanguard for the sturdy utility of the pines. A few minutes later, the moaning started. For a moment, I thought it was in my head. Then I stopped abruptly, stood there listening. Whatever we had heard every night at dusk was at it again. And in my eagerness to leave the lighthouse, I had forgotten it lived in the reeds. This close, the sound was more guttural, filled with confused anguish and rage. It seemed so utterly human and inhuman that for the second time since entering Area X, I considered the supernatural. The sound came from ahead of me and from the landward side, through the thick reeds that kept the water from the sides of the trail. It seemed unlikely I could pass by without it hearing me. And what then? Finally, I decided to forge ahead. I took out the smaller of my two flashlights and crouched as I turned it on, so the beam couldn't easily be seen above the reeds. In this awkward way, I walked forward, gun drawn in my other hand, alert to the direction of the sound. Soon I could hear it closer, if still distant, pushing through the reeds as it continued its horrible moaning. A few minutes passed, and I made good progress. Then, abruptly, something nudged against my boot, flopped over. I aimed my flashlight at the ground, and leapt back, gasping. Incredibly, a human face seemed to be rising out of the earth. But when, after a moment, nothing further happened, I shone my light on it again, and saw it was a kind of tan mask made of skin, half-transparent, resembling in its way the discarded shell of a horseshoe crab. A wide face with a hint of pockmarks across the left cheek. The eyes were blank, sightless, staring. I felt as if I should recognize these features, that it was very important, but with them disembodied in this way, I could not. Somehow the sight of this mask restored to me a measure of the calm that I had lost during my conversation with the psychologist. No matter how strange, a discarded exoskeleton, even if part of it resembled a human face, represented a kind of solvable mystery. One that, for the moment at least, pushed back the disturbing image of an expanding border and the countless lies told by the southern reach. When I bent at the knees and shone my flashlight ahead, I saw more detritus from a kind of molting, a long trail of skin-like debris, husks, and sloughings. Clearly, I might soon meet with what had shed this material, and just as clearly the moaning creature was, or had once been, human. I recalled the deserted village, the staring eyes of the dolphins. A question existed there that I might in time answer in too personal a way, but the most important question in that moment was whether just after molting the thing became sluggish or more active. It depended on the species, and I was not an expert on this one, nor did I have much stamina left for a new encounter, even though it was too late to retreat. Continuing on, I came to a place on the left where the reeds had been flattened, veering off to form a path about 3 feet wide. The moltings, if that's what they were, veered off too. Shining my flashlight down the path, I could see it curved sharply right after less than 100 feet. This meant that the creature was already ahead of me, out in the reeds, and could possibly circle back and emerge to block my path back to base camp. The dragging sounds had intensified, almost equal to the moaning. A thick musk clung to the air. I still had no desire to return to the lighthouse, so I picked up my pace. Now the darkness was so complete I could only see a few feet ahead of me, the flashlight revealing little or nothing. I felt as if I were moving through an encircling tunnel. The moaning grew still louder, but I could not determine its direction. The smell became a special kind of stench. The ground began to sag a little under my weight, and I knew water must be close. There came the moaning again, as close as I'd ever heard it, but now mixed with a loud, thrashing sound. I stopped and stood on tiptoe to shine my flashlight over the reeds, to my left, in time to see a great disrupting wave of motion ahead at a right angle to the trail and closing fast. A dislocation of the reeds, a fast smashing that made them fall as if machine threshed. The thing was trying to outflank me, and the brightness within me surged to cover my panic. I hesitated for just a moment. Some part of me wanted to see the creature, after having heard it for so many days. Was it the remnants of the scientist in me, trying to regroup, trying to apply logic when all that mattered was survival? If so, it was a very small part. I ran. It surprised me how fast I could run. I'd never had to run that fast before. Down the tunnel of blackness lined with reeds, raked by them and not caring, willing the brightness to propel me forward, to get past the beast before it cut me off. I could feel the thudding vibration of its passage, the rasping clack of the reeds beneath its tread, and there was a kind of expectant tone to its moaning, now that sickened me with the urgency of its seeking. From out of the darkness there came an impression of a great weight aimed at me from my left, a suggestion of the side of a tortured, pale visage and a great ponderous bulk behind it. Barreling toward a point ahead of me, and me with no choice but to let it keep coming, lunging forward like a sprinter at the finish line, so I could be past it and free. It was coming so fast, too fast. I could tell I wasn't going to make it, couldn't possibly make it, not at that angle, but I was committed now. The crucial moment came. I thought I felt its hot breath on my side, flinched and cried out even as I ran. But then the way was clear, and from almost right behind me I heard a high keening and the feeling of the space. The air suddenly filled, and the sound of something massive trying to break, trying to change direction, and being pulled into the reeds on the opposite side of the trail by its own momentum. An almost plaintive keening, a lonely sound in that place, called out to me, and kept calling, pleading for me to return, to see it entire, to acknowledge its existence. I did not look back. I kept running. Eventually, gasping for air, I stopped. On rubbery legs, I walked until the trail opened up into forest lands, far enough to find a large oak I could climb, and spent the night in an uncomfortable position wedged into a crook of the tree. If the moaning creature had followed me there, I don't know what I would have done. I could still hear it, though far distant again. I did not want to think about it, but I could not stop thinking about it. I drifted in and out of sleep, one watchful eye on the ground. Once something large and snuffling paused at the base of the tree, but then went on its way. Another time, I had the sense of vague shapes moving in the middle distance, but nothing came of it. They seemed to stop for a moment, luminous eyes floating in the dark, but I sensed no threat from them. I held my husband's journal to my chest like a talisman to ward off the night, still refusing to open it. My fears about what it might contain had only grown. Sometime before morning, I woke again to find that my brightness had become literal. My skin gave off a faint phosphorescence against the darkness, and I tried to hide my hands in my sleeves, draw my collar up high, so I would be less visible, then drifted off again. Part of me just wanted to sleep forever, through the rest of anything that might occur. But I did remember one thing now. Where I had seen the molted mask before, the psychologist from the 11th expedition, a man I had seen interviewed after his return across the border, a man who had said, in a calm and even tone, "It was quite beautiful, quite peaceful in Area X. We saw nothing unusual, nothing at all." And then, had smiled in a vague way. Death, as I was beginning to understand it, was not the same thing here as back across the border. The next morning, my head was still full of the moans of the creature as I re-entered the part of Area X where the trail rose to a steep incline, and on either side of the swampy black water was littered with the deceptively dead-seeming cypress knees. The water stole all sound, and its unmoving surface reflected back only gray moss and tree limbs. I loved this part of the trail as I loved no other. Here the world had a watchfulness matched only by a sense of peaceful solitude. The stillness was simultaneously an invitation to let down your guard and a rebuke against letting down your guard. Base camp was a mile away, and I was lazy with the light and the hum of insects in the tall grass. I was already rehearsing what I would say to the surveyor, what I would tell her, and what I would withhold. The brightness within me flared up. I had time to take a half step to the right. The first shot took me in the left shoulder instead of the heart, and the impact twisted me as it pushed me back. The second shot ripped through my left side, not so much lifting me off my feet as making me spin and trip myself into the profound silence. As I hit the incline and jounced down the hill, there came a roaring in my ears. I lay at the bottom of the hill, breath knocked out of me, one outstretched hand plunged into the black water and the other arm trapped beneath me. The pain in my left side seemed at first as if someone kept opening me up with a butcher knife and sewing me back together, but it quickly subsided to a kind of roiling ache, the bullet wounds reduced, through some cellular conspiracy, to a sensation like the slow squirming inside me of tiny animals. Only seconds had passed. I knew I had to move. Luckily, my gun had been holstered, or it would have gone flying. I took it out now. I had seen the scope, a tiny circle in the tall grass, recognized who had set the ambush. The surveyor was ex-military and good, but she couldn't know that the brightness had protected me, that shock wasn't overtaking me, that the wound hadn't transfixed me with paralyzing pain. I rolled onto my belly, intending to crawl along the water's edge. Then I heard the surveyor's voice calling out to me from the other side of the embankment. "Where is the psychologist? What did you do with her?" I made the mistake of telling the truth. "She's dead," I called back, trying to make my voice sound shaky and weak. The surveyor's only reply was to fire a round over my head, perhaps hoping I would break cover. "I didn't kill the psychologist," I shouted. "She jumped from the top of the lighthouse." "Risk for reward," the surveyor responded, throwing it back at me like a grenade. She must have thought about that moment the whole time I'd been gone. It had no more effect on me than had my attempt to use it on her. "Listen to me. You've hurt me, badly. You can leave me out here. I'm not your enemy." Pathetic words, placating words. I waited, but the surveyor didn't reply. There was just the buzzing of the bees around the wildflowers, a gurgling of water somewhere in the black swamp beyond the embankment. I looked up at the stunning blue of the sky and wondered if it was time to start moving. "Go back to base camp. Take the supplies," I shouted, trying again. "Return to the border. I don't care. I won't stop you." "I don't believe you about any of it," she shouted, the voice a little closer, advancing along the other side. Then, "You've come back, and you're not human anymore. You should kill yourself so I don't have to." I didn't like her casual tone. "I'm as human as you," I replied. "This is a natural thing," and realized she wouldn't understand that I was referring to the brightness. I wanted to say that I was a natural thing, too, but I didn't know the truth of that, and none of this was helping plead my case anyway. "Tell me your name," she screamed. "Tell me your name. Tell me your goddamn fucking name." That won't make any difference, I shouted back. How would that make any difference? I don't understand why that makes a difference. Silence was my answer. She would speak no more. I was a demon, a devil, something she couldn't understand or had chosen not to. I could feel her coming ever closer, crouching for cover. She wouldn't fire again until she had a clear shot, whereas I had the urge to just charge her, firing wildly. Instead, I half crawled, half crept toward her, fast along the water's edge. She might expect me to get away by putting distance between us, but I knew with the range of her rifle that was suicidal. I tried to slow my breathing. I wanted to be able to hear any sound she might make, giving away her position. After a moment, I heard footsteps opposite me on the other side of the hill. I found a clump of muddy earth, and I lobbed it low and long down the edge of the black water, back the way I had come. As it was landing about 50 feet from me with a gluttonous plop, I was edging my way up the hillside so I could just barely see the edge of the trail. The top of the surveyor's head rose up, not 10 feet ahead of me. She had dropped down to crawl through the long grass of the path. It was just a momentary glimpse. She was in plain view for less than a second, and then would be gone. I didn't think. I didn't hesitate. I shot her. Her head jolted to the side, and she slumped soundlessly into the grass and turned over on her back with a groan, as if she had been disturbed in her sleep, and then lay still. The side of her face was covered with blood, and her forehead looked grotesquely misshapen. I slid back down the incline. I was staring at my gun, shocked. I felt as if I were stuck between two futures, even though I had already made the decision to live in one of them. Now, it was just me. When I checked again, cautious and low against the side of the hill, I saw her still sprawled there, unmoving. I had never killed anyone before. I was not sure, given the logic of this place, that I had truly killed someone now. At least, this was what I told myself to control my shakes. Because behind it all, I kept thinking that I could have tried to reason with her a little longer, or not taken the shot, and escaped into the wilderness. I got up and made my way up the hill, feeling sore all over, although my shoulder remained just a dull ache. Standing over the body, her rifle lying straight above her bloody head, like an exclamation mark, I wondered what her last hours had been like at base camp, what doubts had racked her. If she had started back to the border, hesitated, returned to the camp, set out again, caught in a circle of indecision. Surely some trigger had driven her to confront me, or perhaps living alone in her own head overnight in this place had been enough. Solitude could press down on a person, seemed to demand that action be taken. If I had come back when I'd promised, might it all have been different? I couldn't leave her there, but I hesitated about taking her back to base camp and burying her in the old graveyard behind the tents. The brightness within me made me unsure. What if there was a purpose for her in this place? Would burying her circumvent an ability to change that might belong to her, even now? Finally, I rolled her over and over, the skin still elastic and warm, blood spooling out of the wound in her head, until she reached the water's edge. Then I said a few words about how I hoped she would forgive me, and how I forgave her for shooting at me. I don't know if my words made much sense to either of us at that point. It all sounded absurd to me as I said it. If she had suddenly been resurrected, we would probably both admit we forgave nothing. Carrying her in my arms, I waded into the black water. I let her go when I was knee-deep and watched her sink. When I could no longer see even the outstretched pale anemone of her left hand, I waded back to shore. I did not know if she was religious, expected to be resurrected in heaven or become food for the worms, but regardless, the cypress trees formed a kind of cathedral over her as she went deeper and deeper. I had no time to absorb what had just happened, however. Soon after I stood once again on the trail, the brightness usurped many more places than just my nerve centers. I crumpled to the ground, cocooned in what felt like an encroaching winter of dark ice, the brightness spreading into the corona of brilliant blue light with a white core. It felt like cigarette burns as a kind of searing snow drifted down and infiltrated my skin. Soon I became so frozen, so utterly numb, trapped there on the trail in my own body, that my eyes became fixed on the thick blades of grass in front of me, my mouth half open in the dirt. There should have been an awareness of comfort at being spared the pain of my wounds, but I was being haunted in my delirium. I can remember only 3 moments from these hauntings. In the first, the surveyor, psychologist, and anthropologist peered down at me through ripples as if I were a tadpole staring up through a pool of water. They kept staring for an abnormally long time. In the second, I sat beside the moaning creature, my hand upon its head, as I murmured something in a language I did not understand. In the third, I stared at a living map of the border, which had been depicted as if it were a great circular moat surrounding Area X. In that moat, vast sea creatures swam, oblivious to me watching them. I could feel the absence of their regard like a kind of terrible bereavement. All that time, I discovered later from thrash marks in the grass, I wasn't frozen at all. I was spasming and twitching in the dirt like a worm, some distant part of me still experiencing the agony, trying to die because of it, even though the brightness wouldn't let it happen. If I could have reached my gun, I think I would have shot myself in the head and been glad of it. It may be clear by now that I am not always good at telling people things they feel they have a right to know, and in this account thus far, I have neglected to mention some details about the brightness. My reason for this is, again, the hope that any reader's initial opinion in judging my objectivity might not be influenced by these details. I have tried to compensate by revealing more personal information than I would otherwise, in part because of its relevance to the nature of Area X. The truth is that in the moments before the surveyor tried to kill me, the brightness expanded within me to enhance my senses, and I could feel the shifting of the surveyor's hips as she lay against the ground and zeroed in on me through the scope. I could hear the sound of the beads of sweat as they trickled down her forehead. I could smell the deodorant she wore, and I could taste the yellowing grass she had flattened to set her ambush. When I shot her, it was with these enhanced senses still at work, and that was the only reason she was vulnerable to me. This was, in extremis, a sudden exaggeration of what I had been experiencing already. On the way to the lighthouse and back, the brightness had manifested in part as a low-grade cold. I had run a mild fever, had coughed, and had sinus difficulties. I had felt faint at times and lightheaded. A floating sensation and a heaviness had run through my body at intervals, never with any balance, so that I was either buoyant or dragging. My husband would have been proactive about the brightness. He would have found 1,000 ways to try to cure it and to take away the scars, too, and not let me deal with it on my own terms, which is why during our time together I sometimes didn't tell him when I was sick. But in this case, anyway, all of that effort on his part would have been pointless. You can either waste time worrying about a death that might not come, or concentrate on what's left to you. When I finally returned to my senses, it was already noon of the next day. Somehow, I had managed to drag myself back to base camp. I was wrung out, a husk that needed to gulp down almost 1 gallon of water over the next hours to feel whole. My side burned, but I could tell that too quick repair was taking place, enough for me to move about. The brightness, which had already infiltrated my limbs, now seemed, in one final surge, to have been fought to a draw by my body. its progress stunted by the need to tend to my injuries. The cold symptoms had receded, and the lightness, the heaviness, had been replaced by a constant sustaining hum within me, and for a time an unsettling sensation, as of something creeping under my skin, forming a layer that perfectly mimicked the one that could be seen. I knew not to trust this feeling of well-being, that it could simply be the interregnum before another stage. Any relief that thus far the changes seemed no more radical than enhanced senses and reflexes and phosphorescent tint to my skin paled before what I had now learned. To keep the brightness in check, I would have to continue to become wounded, to be injured, to shock my system. In that context, when confronted with the chaos that was base camp, my attitude was perhaps more prosaic than it might have been otherwise. The surveyor had hacked at the tents until long strips of the tough canvas fabric hung loose. The remaining records of scientific data left by prior expeditions had been burned. I could still see blackened fragments sticking out of the ash-crumbled logs. Any weapons she had been unable to carry with her, she had destroyed by carefully taking them apart piece by piece. Then she had scattered the pieces all around the camp as if to challenge me. Emptied out cans of food lay strewn and gaping across the entire area. In my absence, the surveyor had become a kind of frenzied serial killer of the inanimate. Her journal lay like an enticement on the remains of her bed in her tent, surrounded by a flurry of maps, some old and yellowing. But it was blank. Those few times I had seen her apart from us, writing in it had been a deception. She had never had any intention of letting the psychologist or any of us know her true thoughts. I found I respected that. Still, she had left one final pithy statement on a piece of paper by the bed, which perhaps helped explain her hostility. "The anthropologist tried to come back, but I took care of her." She had either been crazy or all too sane. I carefully sorted through the maps, but they were not of Area X. She had written things on them, personal things that spoke to remembrance, until I realized that the maps must show places she had visited or lived. I could not fault her for returning to them, for searching for something from the past that might anchor her in the present, no matter how futile that quest. As I explored the remains of base camp further, I took stock of my situation. I found a few cans of food she had somehow overlooked. She had also missed some of the drinking water because, as I always did, I had secreted some of it in my sleeping bag. Although all of my samples were gone, these, I imagined, she'd flung into the black swamp on her way back down the trail to set her ambush, nothing had been solved or helped by this behavior. I kept my measurements and observations about samples in a small notebook in my knapsack. I would miss a larger, more powerful microscope, but the one I'd packed would do. I had enough food to last me a couple of weeks, as I did not eat much. My water would last another 3 or 4 days. Beyond that, and I could always boil more. I had enough matches to keep a fire going for a month, and the skills to create one without matches anyway. More supplies awaited me in the lighthouse, at the very least, in the psychologist's knapsack. Out back, I saw what the surveyor had added to the old graveyard, an empty, newly dug grave with a mound of dirt out to the side, and stabbed into the ground a simple cross made from fallen branches. Had the grave been meant to hold me, or the anthropologist, or both? I did not like the idea of lying next to the anthropologist for all eternity. Cleaning up a little later, a fit of laughter came out of nowhere and made me double up in pain. I had suddenly remembered doing the dishes after dinner the night my husband had come back across the border. I could distinctly recall wiping the spaghetti and chicken scraps from a plate and wondering with a kind of bewilderment how such a mundane act could coexist with the mystery of his reappearance. 5. Dissolution. I've never done well in cities, even though I lived in one by necessity, because my husband needed to be there, because the best jobs for me were there, because I had self-destructed when I'd had opportunities in the field. But I was not a domesticated animal. The dirt and grit of a city, the unending wakefulness of it, the crowdedness, the constant light obscuring the stars, the omnipresent gasoline fumes, the thousand ways it presaged our destruction. None of these things appealed to me. "Where do you go so late at night?" my husband had asked several times, about 9 months before he left as part of the 11th expedition. There was an unspoken "really" before the "go." I could hear it, loud and insistent. "Nowhere," I said. "Everywhere." "No, really, where do you go?" It was to his credit that he'd never tried to follow me. "I'm not cheating on you, if that's what you mean." The directness of that usually stopped him, even if it didn't reassure him. I had told him a late-night walk alone relaxed me, allowed me to sleep when the stress and boredom of my job became too much. But in truth, I didn't walk except the distance to an empty lot overgrown with grass. The empty lot appealed to me because it wasn't truly empty. 2 species of snail called it home, and 3 species of lizard, along with butterflies and dragonflies. From lowly origins, a muddy rut from truck tires, a puddle had over time collected rainwater to become a pond. Fish eggs had found their way to that place, and minnows and tadpoles could be seen there, and aquatic insects. Weeds had grown up around it, making the soil less likely to erode into the water. Songbirds on migration used it as a refueling station. As habitats went, the lot wasn't complex, but its proximity dulled the impulse in me to get in a car and start driving to the nearest wild place. I liked to visit late at night because I might see a wary fox passing through or catch a sugar glider resting on a telephone pole. Nighthawks gathered nearby to feast off the insects bombarding the street lamps. Mice and owls played out ancient rituals of predator and prey. They all had a watchfulness about them that was different from animals in true wilderness. This was a jaded watchfulness, the result of a long and weary history, tales of bad faith encounters in human-occupied territory, tragic past events. I didn't tell my husband my walk had a destination because I wanted to keep the lot for myself. There are so many things couples do from habit and because they are expected to, and I didn't mind those rituals. Sometimes I even enjoyed them, but I needed to be selfish about that patch of urban wilderness. It expanded in my mind while I was at work, calmed me, gave me a series of miniature dramas to look forward to. I didn't know that while I was applying this band-aid to my need to be unconfined, my husband was dreaming of Area X and much greater open spaces. But later the parallel helped assuage my anger at his leaving, and then my confusion when he came back in such a changed form, even if the stark truth is that I still did not truly understand what I had missed about him. The psychologist had said, "The border is advancing a little bit more every year." But I found that statement too limiting, too ignorant. There were thousands of dead spaces like the lot I had observed, thousands of transitional environments that no one saw, that had been rendered invisible because they were not of use. Anything could inhabit them for a time without anyone noticing. We had come to think of the border as this monolithic, invisible wall. But if members of the 11th expedition had been able to return without our noticing, couldn't other things have already gotten through? In this new phase of my brightness, recovering from my wounds, the tower called incessantly to me. I could feel its physical presence under the earth with a clarity that mimicked the first flush of attraction, when you knew without looking exactly where the object of desire stood in the room. Part of this was my own need to return, but part might be due to the effect of the spores, and so I fought it because I had work to do first. This work might also, if I was left to do it without any strange intercession, put everything in perspective. To start with, I had to quarantine the lies and obfuscation of my superiors from data that pertained to the actual eccentricities of Area X. For example, the secret knowledge that there had been a proto-Area X, a kind of preamble and beachhead established first. As much as seeing the mound of journals had radically altered my view of Area X, I did not think that the higher number of expeditions told me much more about the tower and its effects. It told me primarily that even if the border was expanding, the progress of assimilation by Area X could still be considered conservative. The recurring data points found in the journals that related to repeating cycles and fluctuations of seasons, of the strange and the ordinary, were useful in establishing trends. But this information, too, my superiors probably knew, and therefore it could be considered something already reported by others. The myth that only a few early expeditions, the start date artificially suggested by the Southern Reach, had come to grief reinforced the idea of cycles existing within the overall framework of an advance. The individual details chronicled by the journals might tell stories of heroism or cowardice, of good decisions and bad decisions, but ultimately they spoke to a kind of inevitability. No one had as yet plumbed the depths of intent or purpose in a way that had obstructed that intent or purpose. Everyone had died or been killed, returned changed or returned unchanged, but Area X had continued on as it always had, while our superiors seemed to fear any radical reimagining of this situation so much that they had continued to send in knowledge-strapped expeditions as if this was the only option. Feed Area X, but do not antagonize it, and perhaps someone will, through luck or mere repetition, hit upon some explanation, some solution, before the world becomes Area X. There was no way I could corroborate any of these theories, but I took a grim comfort in coming up with them anyway. I left my husband's journal until last, even though its pull was as strong as the allure of the tower. Instead, I focused on what I had brought back, the samples from the ruined village and from the psychologist, along with samples of my own skin. I set up my microscope on the rickety table, which I suppose the surveyor had found already so damaged it did not require her further attention. The cells of the psychologist, both from her unaffected shoulder and her wound, appeared to be normal human cells. So did the cells I examined from my own sample. This was impossible. I checked the samples over and over, even childishly, pretending I had no interest in looking at them before swooping down with an eagle eye. I was convinced that when I wasn't looking at them, these cells became something else, that the very act of observation changed everything. I knew this was madness, and yet still I thought it. I felt as if Area X were laughing at me then. Every blade of grass, every stray insect, every drop of water. What would happen when the crawler reached the bottom of the tower? What would happen when it came back up? Then I examined the samples from the village. Moss from the forehead of one of the eruptions, splinters of wood, a dead fox, a rat. The wood was indeed wood. The rat was indeed a rat. The moss and the fox were composed of modified human cells. Where lies the strangling fruit that came from the hand of the sinner, I shall bring forth the seeds of the dead. I suppose I should have reared back from the microscope in shock, but I was beyond such reactions to anything that instrument might show me. Instead, I contented myself with quiet cursing. The boar on the way to base camp, the strange dolphins, the tormented beast in the reeds. Even the idea that replicas of members of the 11th expedition had crossed back over all supported the evidence of my microscope. Transformations were taking place here, and as much as I had felt part of a natural landscape on my trek to the lighthouse, I could not deny that these habitats were transitional in a deeply unnatural way. A perverse sense of relief overtook me At least now I had proof of something strange happening, along with the brain tissue the anthropologist had taken from the skin of the crawler. By then, though, I had enough of samples. I ate lunch and decided against putting more effort into cleaning up the camp. Most of that task would have to fall to the next expedition. It was another brilliant, blinding afternoon of stunning blue sky, allied with a comfortable heat. I sat for a time, watched the dragonflies skimming the long grass, the dipping, looping flight of a red-headed woodpecker. I was just putting off the inevitable, my return to the tower, and yet still I wasted time. When I finally picked up my husband's journal and started to read, the brightness washed over me in unending waves and connected me to the earth, the water, the trees, the air, as I opened up and kept on opening. Nothing about my husband's journal was expected, except for some terse, hastily scribbled exceptions. He had addressed most of the entries to me. I did not want this, and as soon as it became apparent, I had to resist the need to throw the journal away from me as if it were poison. My reaction had nothing to do with love or lack of love, but was more out of the sense of guilt. He had meant to share this journal with me, and now he was either truly dead or existed in a state beyond any possible way for me to communicate with him, to reciprocate. The 11th expedition had consisted of 8 members, all male, a psychologist, 2 medics, including my husband, a linguist, a surveyor, a biologist, an anthropologist, and an archaeologist. They had come to Area X in the winter, when the trees had lost most of their leaves and the reeds had turned darker and thicker. The flowering bushes became sullen and seemed to huddle along the path, as he put it. Fewer birds than indicated in reports, he wrote, but where do they go? Only the ghost bird knows. The sky frequently clouded over, and the water level in the cypress swamps was low. No rain the entire time we've been here, he wrote at the end of the first week. They, too, discovered what only I call the tower on their 5th or 6th day. I was ever more certain that the location of the base camp had been chosen to trigger that discovery, but their surveyor's opinion that they must continue mapping the wider area meant they followed a different course than ours. None of us were eager to climb down in there, my husband wrote. Me least of all. My husband had claustrophobia, sometimes even had to leave our bed in the middle of the night to go sleep on the deck. For whatever reason, the psychologist did not in this case coerce the expedition to go down into the tower. They explored farther, past the ruined village, to the lighthouse and beyond. Of the lighthouse, my husband noted their horror at discovering the signs of carnage, but of being too respectful of the dead to put things right, by which I suppose he meant the overturned tables on the ground level. He did not mention the photograph of the lighthouse keeper on the wall of the landing, which disappointed me. Like me, they had discovered the pile of journals at the top of the lighthouse, been shaken by it. We had an intense argument about what to do. I wanted to abort the mission and return home because clearly we'd been lied to. But it was at this point that the psychologist apparently reestablished control, if of a tenuous sort. One of the directives from Area X was for each expedition to remain a unit. But in the very next entry, the expedition had decided to split up, as if to salvage the mission by catering solely to each person's will, and thus ensuring that no one would try to return to the border. The other medic, the anthropologist, the archaeologist, and the psychologist stayed in the lighthouse to read the journals and investigate the area around the lighthouse. The linguist and the biologist went back to explore the tower. My husband and the surveyor continued on past the lighthouse. "You would love it here," he wrote in a particularly manic entry that suggested to me not so much optimism as an unsettling euphoria. "You would love the light on the dunes. You would love the sheer expansive wildness of it." They wandered up the coast for an entire week, mapping the landscape and fully expecting at some point to encounter the border, whatever form it might take, some obstacle that barred their progress. But they never did. Instead, the same habitat confronted them day after day.
"We're heading north, I believe," he wrote. "But even though we cover a good 15 to 20 miles by nightfall, nothing has changed. It's all the same."
Although he also was quite emphatic that he did not mean they were somehow caught in a strange recurring loop. Yet he knew that, by all rights, we should have encountered the border by now. Indeed, they were well into an expanse of what he called the Southern Reach that had not yet been charted. That we had been encouraged by the vagueness of our superiors to assume existed back beyond the border. I too knew that Area X ended abruptly, not far past the lighthouse. How did I know this? Our superiors had told us during training, so in fact, I knew nothing at all. They turned back finally because, behind us we saw strange cascading lights far distant, and from the interior, more lights and sounds that we could not identify. We became concerned for the expedition members we had left behind. At the point when they turned back, they had come within sight of a rocky island, the first island we have seen, which they felt a powerful urge to explore, although there was no easy way to get over to it. The island appeared to have been inhabited at one time. We saw stone houses dotting a hill and a dock below. The return trip to the lighthouse took 4 days, not seven, as if the land had contracted. At the lighthouse, they found the psychologist gone and the bloody aftermath of a shootout on the landing halfway up. A dying survivor, the archaeologist, told us that something not of the world had come up the stairs and that it had killed the psychologist and then withdrawn with his body. But the psychologist came back later, the archaeologist raved. There were only two bodies, and neither was the psychologist. He could not account for the absence. He also could not tell us why they had shot each other, except to say, "We did not trust ourselves," over and over again. My husband noted that some of the wounds I saw were not from bullets, and even the blood spatter on the walls did not correspond to what I knew of crime scenes. There was a strange residue on the floor. The archaeologist propped himself up in the corner of the landing and threatened to shoot us if we came close enough to see his wounds. Soon enough, though, he was dead. Afterward, they dragged the bodies from the landing and buried them high up on the beach, a little distance from the lighthouse. It was difficult, Ghost Bird, and I don't know that we ever really recovered. Not really. This left the linguist and the biologist at the tower. The surveyor suggested either going back up the coast past the lighthouse or following the beach down the coast. But we both knew this was just an avoidance of the facts. What he was really saying was that we should abandon the mission, that we should lose ourselves in the landscape. That landscape was impinging on them now. The temperature dipped and rose violently. There were rumblings deep underground that manifested as slight tremors. The sun came to them with a greenish tinge, as if somehow the border were distorting our vision. They also saw flocks of birds headed inland, not of the same species, but hawks and ducks, herons and eagles, all grouped together as if in common cause. At the tower, they ventured only a few levels down before coming back up. I noticed no mention of words on the wall. If the linguist and the biologist were inside, they were much farther down, but we had no interest in following them. They returned to base camp, only to find the body of the biologist stabbed several times. The linguist had left a note that read simply, "Went to the tunnel. Do not look for me." I felt a strange pang of sympathy for a fallen colleague. No doubt the biologist had tried to reason with the linguist, or so I told myself. Perhaps he had tried to kill the linguist, but the linguist had clearly already been ensnared by the tower, by the words of the crawler. Knowing the meaning of the words on such intimate terms might have been too much for anyone, I realize now. The surveyor and my husband returned to the tower at dusk. Why is not apparent from the journal entries, there began to be breaks that corresponded to the passage of some hours, with no recap. But during the night, they saw a ghastly procession heading into the tower. 7 of the 8 members of the 11th expedition, including a doppelganger of my husband and the surveyor. And there before me